Hello, just a quick bit before this week's episode to let you know that we have a Patreon you can subscribe to if you like what we're doing here and you want more of it. You probably already knew that. We don't stop going on about it. What you didn't know is that you can currently get a little free trial, so you know exactly what you'd get as part of your subscription. You can head to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in the show notes to get your first 7 days free. All you need to do is pick which tier you'd like a free trial of. The Biggest Mates tier is the one that has all the extras in it. And then for 7 days, you are free to listen to any episode we've released in the last 6 months. You can cancel any time or just leave the subscription rolling if you like what you find. It's charged monthly. And during any month, as part of that Biggest Mates tier, you'll get ad-free episodes of this show every Monday. You'll get a brand new episode of our new Manic Street Preacher show every month. 2 episodes every month of the Ultimate Playlist, our themed playlist show, where we talk about all kinds of different music, different artists, different genres, different eras, and 1 or 2 bonus episodes every month, depending on the length of the month. That's 2 episodes every week. There's also other tiers to trial. One that is just the Manic Show and ad-free What Is Music episodes, and another that is just ad-free What Is Music episodes. But hey, if the first 7 days are free, why not try a bit of everything? Plus, all tiers include access to the exclusive subscriber-only Discord where we discuss the shows, the bands we've covered, various music topics, and loads of other stuff, including some games that the friendly community have devised themselves. So head on over to our Patreon page now to claim your free 7-day trial. Go to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in our show notes. See you there. We should do cameos that are all that.
But what we just do Nigel Farage impressions.
Yeah.
Somebody goes, I really want Adam from What Is Music to just record my mate a little message because he's a fan of the podcast.
And you just do Sussy Backer Pirate from Basildon, very cringe.
With a Nigel Farage mask.
I bet you don't even like Brexit, all of that stuff. Yeah, I think that would be good. On this podcast, we are committed to not giving the people what they want in any way, shape or form.
Just like Nigel Farage.
Exactly.
Yeah. Topical.
Hello. Welcome to What Is Music, a music podcast about music. We are a podcast that focuses on discographies in their entirety. We're doing deep dives on one artist at a time. And you join us for season 6, which is called Are We Enjoying This? A critical analysis of the history, cultural impact and music of REM. We're going through their entire career, album by album, track by track, and we're asking questions like, does context matter when you're listening to music? Does knowing the history of an artist affect your appreciation of their output? And this season we are, of course, asking, are we enjoying this? And to be clear, we're asking, are we enjoying this in regards to REM, not are we enjoying this in regards to this, the 6th season of our podcast, which is called Are We Enjoying This? And which you may or may not have been enjoying. I'm Adam Scott Glasspool. I'm a big music nerd. I'm a big fan of REM. With me, as always, are not one, but 2 of my closest friends. And the first is someone who is not a huge music nerd, probably the least knowledgeable on music in general out of the 3 of us, but is just learning through this podcast how to apply critical thought onto why he likes or dislikes something and whether or not that means it's good. It's Lucas Way.
That's me.
Oh, it's good to have those back. And of course, we have Steve.
Do you think, yeah. Okay. Do you think that 2 of us is too much?
Yes. I think it should alternate. I think like one episode should be with Lucas, the next one should be with Steve. I'm on all of them, obviously.
Yeah.
But it should alternate. I think three is too many.
If it's a 5-week month, it's just you on your own as a little treat for the listeners.
A little treat for the listeners they don't have to hear from either of you.
Yeah.
to be clear, the money still gets split 3 ways, right?
It's yep, 3 ways now.
That's the only thing that's shared equally on this podcast, isn't it? It's the money.
Yeah, that's good.
So how are you guys? Are you very well? How are you feeling? I can hear about 4 or 5 different colds amongst us.
Yeah. Among us.
We've all been cold.
I very specifically said amongst.
We've all been colding a little bit.
I'm coming to the end of my like 3rd one in 2 months. So I'm a big brave boy and I'm here. I've got a vitamins in a water. So
anyway, on this podcast, we're exploring the entire discography of REM. And in the last few weeks, what we've been doing, we dissected and discussed their 4th album, Life's Rich Pageant, which brought us up to the end of 1986. And so this week, we're going to explore and review Dead Letter office in order to get a little bit closer to answering the question, what is music? Lucas, do you remember exactly where we left off with REM? You know, their kind of status, their position, as it were?
So no is the answer. Okay, cool. I don't remember where we left them.
Bless you. So they released Life's Rich Pageant.
Yeah,
critical acclaim as usual, but very crucially this time, you'll remember this, increased commercial success, 500,000 copies in 6 months. It was that step into the mainstream. They decided not to do another long, grueling tour and instead only toured North America in support of the album. The pageantry tour, as it's called. It ended in November 1986. And then like they did between Fables and Pageant, they do have a little break. But it's again interspersed with little bits of stuff that the band members all get up to. Peter Buck, who is REM, gets around and he plays guitar at a few shows for artists like Imitation Life, The Feelies, Peter Case, all of these bands that we know and love. They're perennial favourites of the podcast. Michael Stipe crops up to sing on some songs with other artists, whether recorded or live. The players of REM, Berry, Buck and Mills, they become Warren Zevon's backing band for his album Sentimental Hygiene.
Who's that?
Well, I'll show you in a minute.
Sentimental Hygiene.
Sentimental Hygiene
There's
is the name
great
of the album.
Band names around this whole scene.
Well,
I love it.
That's the album name.
Okay, fine.
And then while they're in the studio with Warren Zevon, they also record an album of covers with him, obviously as their side project, the Hindu Love Gods.
Mm-hmm, of course, yes.
While they're there. Why not? So Sentimental Hygiene, yeah, it's a Warren Zevon album. You do know Warren Zevon because you know Werewolves of London. Din, 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 din. Ah, woo! Werewolves of London. You do know the song. You
would probably do, but from that...
I remember the bit of the ah, woo, because obviously I remember that from when me and Steve regularly go out and bark at the moon.
Yeah, we haven't done that for a while, actually. But it's because I'm feeling a little bit self-conscious, putting on a little bit of weight, and we do strip to the ankles. Keep our shoes on, we're not animals. Until we bark at the moon.
We are animals.
At that point, we're not animals.
Okay.
And then it becomes blurry.
I'm always
And then
a
it becomes all very blurry. And
you're just a sheep, Steve. You're just a sheep. Me and Adam, we're wolves of the pack, aren't we, Adam?
Not really. I think insert myself more as like a
insert
turtle.
Insert picture of Tommy Shelby. Yeah.
Here's a clip of Sentimental Hygiene by Warren Zevon. It's the title track from the album. The band that are playing are Peter Buck, Mike Mills and Bill Berry from REM. Every day I get up in the morning, go to work, do my job. Sort of nominally interesting, isn't it?
It is, because it's like they got the name of the track, Sentimental Hygiene, and he's like, right, you need some words before it. He's like, yeah, I get up and I go to my job or whatever, I don't set a mental hygiene. I really like that. That is basically REM with another singer then.
The lead guitar, the guitar solo that comes a little bit later, is Neil Young.
Okay,
incidentally.
Sure.
You know, the legendary
You just
musician.
Get in Neil Young, don't you?
Neil Young. Yeah, you just quickly just pop Neil Young on that. REM, though, they are also, of course, writing songs and recording demos for their fifth album. But we'll look into that in a little bit more detail a little further down the line. Because before the next album comes out, the band releases something else. And I'm not necessarily asking you what it's called or anything, but what is it? What is the thing that they release?
Well, it's called Dead Letter Office.
Yeah, nailed it.
It's a B-sides collection.
Yes. Yes, it is.
B-sides and also sort of just like...
Curios, is
bits.
It?
Bits. Curios, that's a good word.
I've always described it and heard it described as B-sides and rarities, right? But I think it's B-side and rarity, because there's only one track on the whole thing that hasn't been released as a B-side.
Oh, really? So, okay.
Yeah. So it's pretty much a B-sides collection with one thing that is from the soundtrack of a movie.
Right. A lot of the B-sides could also be described as curios, I think.
Yeah. 100%, yeah. They are not the kind of B-sides that we are maybe typically used to from B-sides collections, which I'm sure we'll get into, because we've done a couple of B-sides collections already. But this one is called Dead Letter Office, and it was released on April the 27th, 1987 in the US, May the 1st in the UK. So it comes out just 9 months after Life's Rich Pageant, and it's 15 tracks and 43 minutes, which is kind of remarkable that it's 15 tracks, but it's still kind of a decent length. It's not even the longest album that we've covered so far.
It's because some of them don't even feel like tracks. They're just almost like little curios.
He loves it now, doesn't he? That's mine now.
That's my nice, my word. I invented that word.
Yeah, some are 1 minute 30, some are 2 minutes.
Do you know what my favourite breakfast cereal is?
Is it Curios?
Yeah. It's Curios. Honey Nut Curios.
It's produced by, obviously, a mixture of people. Mitch Easter, Don Dixon, Joe Boyd, Don Gemmon. And R.E.M.
But Don Gemmon's back on it.
Well, of course he is, because yeah, they're all from the previous albums, aren't they?
Of course. So the cartoon frog gets a little go.
I forgot about the frog. Don Gemmon.
Gemmon, the cartoon frog.
The artwork is by R.A. Miller and Ron Scarcelli. It's a simple design.
There it is. Adam's got his big vinyl out.
I have it in front of me here. It has that kind of folk art vibe to it. Quite simple. It's also quite bold. It has
like a rug.
The name of the band and the title on it. The track listing. All of the tracks are present.
That's good.
They're in alphabetical order.
For goodness sake.
Okay.
Okay.
So they're not in the order. Okay. They're not in the order that they appear on the album.
They're just so difficult people, aren't they?
They really are. They're really difficult. What do you think of the title, Dead Letter Office?
Three random words.
Interesting.
It conjures up a like anti-corporate.
An anti-post office.
Okay, that's really interesting. I really like it. It's a real concept. It's a real thing. So it's not just three random things put together. It is the office where undeliverable mail goes. It's the dead letter office. It usually goes there because there is no address or there is an incomplete address and nowhere for the mail to go, which is what these songs are. They are songs that didn't fit on the albums that they were recorded alongside.
Very good.
So this is where they go.
They go
to the dead letter office.
Yeah.
And I think there's something quite knowing about that. I think there is a certain amount of humour in that title, and I think there's a certain amount of humour across the whole release. And I think it's interesting how that compares to the other B-sides collections we've done. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, we've done two, I think. We've done
Lipstick Traces.
And I'm going to give you the titles. Yes, Lipstick Traces, A Secret History of Manic Street Preachers is the full title of that B-sides collection. And of course, we've done Hullabaloo
the DVD.
By Muse. Yeah, well, some of it was a DVD, some of it was a CD.
Oh, was it?
And some of it was disc two and some was disc one of a DVD.
Oh, wait, no, it was a CD. It was two CDs.
But we only covered one of the CDs.
But we covered the DVD
of the other CD.
The visual component of the second CD in the CD. Guys, like a...
No. The first CD, because isn't it disc one, the live, and disc two is the B-sides?
No, disc one is the B-sides.
Are you sure?
Yeah. The main thing of the Hullabaloo release was the B-sides. Anyway, the Mannix one, quite serious, I think. Them calling it like a secret history of Manic Street Preachers.
Yeah, these are hidden gems that you've unearthed.
Yeah, it gave me the impression that they were saying like, here's what you missed and this should be taken as seriously or held up with our main output, you know? Like, we're saying that these 20 songs that we've put on disc one of Lipstick Traces are... stand, you know, next to the greatest hits that we released last year, or they stand next to some of our album tracks or whatever.
What was on disc two?
All the covers, 15.
Oh
covers.
Yeah, okay, right, yeah, okay. And
it came out at a point where Manic Street Preachers were coming to terms with their legacy in some ways. You know what I mean? Muse, I think, also relatively, it's a serious title. It has a serious sort of mood to it, or is it? It's at least in keeping with how serious the band was at that point. Was it just after Showbiz and Origin of Symmetry, and before Absolution? So, and that had quite a deliberately chosen track listing of only 10 tracks, you know, and those 10 are just, they're kind of some of their more serious or moody pieces. You don't listen to Hullabaloo and go, I can't believe that's Muse or anything. But I do think that Hullabaloo was released when it was released for a similar reason to this one. And what do you think that, why do you think they released this when they did?
Because of moving record label, and the record label wanted to cash out on them one more time.
Not really. They still have more room to go on the contract. So it's not that it's coming.
I thought I read somewhere that they changed labels after this, but I was wrong.
No, so they don't.
It's after Document, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Spoilers.
Oh. Documents, not next. Is that better?
But I'd say that half of your assertion is correct. I'd say it's a bit of a cash in to some degree. Like, IRS had been working with REM since what, 1981? And it took REM 5 years to hit some kind of mainstream success with Life's Rich Pageant. So when they do, I think the record label is looking to maybe recoup what must have been a fair amount of expenses, or at least make some money off the band while they can. I think they would have been conscious of the idea that the label was kind of, you know, that the contract was coming to an end. And maybe REM were looking like they weren't gonna sign. Maybe there's something in that, you know?
Or they thought, we don't fucking know what these guys are thinking. They're successful now. What's very quick to release some stuff they've already done?
So IRS are making it their business to capitalize on the newfound popularity of REM, I suppose.
And what does the Inland Revenue Service have to do with REM?
It's quite interesting how we've got this far without that one.
Yeah.
I think we've had it.
I've been saving it for like the perfect moment. Okay, and that was it. That was that moment.
That was it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a deliberate play on that, isn't it? Obviously, does it stand for International Record Syndicate?
I like how you're asking us as if that is a question to be directed to us.
Their logo looks like a taxman. It's like a guy in like a trilby and sunglasses.
That's good.
Yeah, I like that. Anyway, if they want to cash in, it's their prerogative. Needless to say, as I'm sure you can figure out by the way we've been talking about them on this season so far, REM, little bit wary of that kind of thing. Peter Buck especially, who felt as though people would very readily perceive the album as the band trying to cash in and sell some records, which is not unfounded. It did, like I said, it ended up coming out 9 months after Life's Rich Pageant. It's only 4 months before Document, their next album.
Wow, that's quick.
Yeah. It's really quick.
Working on Document, presumably, this time. 100%. They don't smash out Document really quickly.
No. But the band were obviously involved in this, Peter Buck especially. So it becomes something slightly more interesting than it could have been. And I get the impression that Peter Buck loves stuff like this. I think he loves archival releases and compilations and glimpses into the creative processes. And there's a half-hour-long song exploder documentary on Netflix that is just about Losing My Religion.
Yes,
and
I think
Peter Buck kind of talks about how much later in their career he's always the one that is pushing for, like, let's release some of these demos, let's let people hear them, because there's going to be a handful of people that are interested in them, and I'd rather they hear them than they're just collecting dust in a vault or something. So I think this is kind of Peter Buck's project, and I think he gets how fun and tangential they can be, rather than having to be very serious works of like, oh, I bet you didn't know that we had songs like this and stuff like that, you know? Which actually is also maybe REM in general, because they're slightly more, I think they're the most fun band that we've done, or certainly the band that take it the least seriously. But it extends to things like this. The Manics and Muse ones, as far as I consider, are quite serious and intended kind of as part of their lineage, as like part of their canon. And our reaction to them has always just to be kind of like, okay, yeah, there's like a handful of good things on there, and there's some shit that is, put it on a t-shirt, absolute bloody B-sides material. You know,
yeah.
That's what we always say about the B-sides that we cover.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think Hullabaloo or Lipstick Traces were immune to that. The thing that's different with this, for me, is that REM know that as well. And I think the Mannix and Muse ones, they're going like, look at this, huh? And we're going like, yeah, okay, well, some of it's shit. And REM are going like, look at this shit. look at some of this shit we've got.
But not to go into my opinions too quickly, but those do also seem like more a collection of more intentional sort of songs that actually maybe could have been on albums, but they didn't make the cut or whatever. Most of this does feel like bits and bobs, covers and
there's six covers, three of them are by the same band.
So it that sounds almost like it's correct that they're not taking it seriously, because it really is a list of a bunch of just curios.
It's like goofy. It's them going like, here's some goofy weird nonsense we have, here's some shit, the kind of stuff that wouldn't even make it to other bands' B-side collections. And I think that that's quite endearing. And because they did that, this is probably, I think it's definitely my favourite B-sides collection that we've covered. And it's probably the most in-canon B-sides collection that we're likely to cover.
That said, they were released as B-sides on singles. So people had, in theory, already heard all this.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that much of a surprise, like, here's some weird shit.
And at this point, singles are actually more of a thing as well. They are still.
You've got to remember where REM chart. Like, they chart at like 100, you know?
Right, okay, yeah, yeah.
And also, some of them are on only, like I think one or two of them are only on, like, the picture disc B-side and things like that.
Oh, okay.
They're not, like, the most accessible version either, to be fair.
And there was a huge disparity in what would be the B-side in the US and what would be the B-side in the UK version of the 7-inch single they were putting out.
Right.
Some of it would have been hard to track down. But then I also think that they don't regard B-sides as anything worth doing. Okay, there's obviously no lyrics are printed, obviously. It's REM in the 80s, okay? But we do get full liner notes from Peter Buck himself.
Right.
Who positions the whole collection, he gives it some context, and he has notes for every single song on the album. And obviously, back in the day, you'd read the liner notes like that. Here they all are. So here is Peter Buck's introduction to Dead Letter Office. I've always liked singles much more than albums. A single has to be short, concise and catchy, all values that seem to go out the window as far as albums are concerned. But the thing I like best about singles is their ultimate shoddiness. No matter how lavish that packaging, no matter what attention to detail, a 45 is still essentially a piece of crap usually purchased by teenagers. This is why musicians feel free to put just about anything on the B-side. Nobody will listen to it anyway, so why not have some fun? You can clear the closet of failed experiments, badly written songs, drunken jokes, and occasionally a worthwhile song that doesn't fit the feel of an album. This collection contains at least one song from each category. It's not a record to be taken too seriously. Listening to this album should be like browsing through a junk shop. Good hunting.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
Fair. How's that for some liner notes, right? That's really
that
cool.
Is good.
I've never really seen a band writing about themselves like that in the sleeve of their own album.
Yeah. And I think we've always posited like B-sides as, oh yeah, it's a song that they recorded for the album, but it didn't quite fit. But yeah, it's funny that the guitarist is saying some drunk jokes on this.
Yeah, we just didn't really consider them. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, some of them do. Some of them clearly aren't like songs. I mean, only a few of them really sound
like
songs.
Some of them aren't
like
songs.
Maybe they did consider.
Yeah.
Some of them are just like, oh, they were mucking around in the studio and they just got it on tape. So
yeah,
use it.
Exactly what he's saying. He's saying there's a couple of worthwhile things on here, but you have to wade through the rubbish to get to it, which I think is great.
Or there's like what can only be described as like a test, like a test run
There's a couple of tracks that are just the tape was running in the studio, and they happened to record something that REM were like doing.
Right.
Yeah. And also though, I think that that sentiment ties in with a statement that we saw Peter Buck make last week on the commentary about albums being, at the end of the day, just a piece of black plastic, which I think is quite a refreshing viewpoint. Because it's positioned like that by the band themselves, I'm like quite up for it. Like, yeah. Sometimes when we cover B-sides, I'm a bit like, oh, okay, I'm going to have to listen to some shit B-sides. Because the band are going, like, here's some shit B-sides, I'm like, oh, great, shit B-sides.
Yeah.
And I guess at the time, you would know that because you would buy it on a record and you'd probably read the liner notes and you'd see that, and that would then contextualize it. Whereas we listened to a playlist on Spotify and had none of that, so I just listened to it and went, what a load of bloody B-sides.
I think the position of the release of this album in their career is quite interesting. People would have definitely known it was B-sides. It was marketed as, quote, a virtuous compost of oddities collared and B-sides compiled. And
oddities.
Yeah, so people would have known that going in, but it's actual sort of like the decisions behind people buying it, I think, is quite interesting. And I did a lot of research on this, on like old message boards and stuff like that. And I reached out to some people, I slid into their DMs basically and talked to them about Dead Letter Office. And these are like old school REM fans. And then I was looking at discussions and stuff like that, which we will go into because I think it's interesting. But what is the album sound like?
Tapes left running in a studio.
Some of it does.
Also, imagine being so successful that all your shitty bits of outtakes, you can be like, well, I'll release that and people will actually pay me good money for that, actually, so good.
But they're not that successful at the moment, though. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, they've sold 500,000 records.
They're successful enough. Like,
I think that they are bold enough. I will say that this album was not a huge, it's not like a rip-roaring success, you know, it's a B-sides collection. But I'd say that they are stupid enough, maybe. I don't know.
Wonder how many streams a month some of these songs get on Spotify.
I like the idea of that somebody at the time would have got Life's Rich Pageant and loved it, and they're like, oh my god, there's a new album by REM, and they'd have run out and they'd have bought it because they really liked the last album. They put this on without like reading anything and gone,
that is what happened. And for that reason, it's some people's favorite REM album. Tom York from Radiohead calls out this album specifically in Meeting People Is Easy, the documentary that we watched, when he's talking about albums that inspired him. Anything firing there for you? Any idea why that might be in terms of what we get on the album?
Because it's showing experimentation.
Well, because it's covers, and so it's things that inspired him because it's other people's things that inspired him.
Yeah, I think there's a degree of that. There's a degree of, like, if you hear your favourite band do a cover of another band, then you go and check out that band and it feeds into your influences that way. Yeah. There's a very, very specific measure of that on Dead Letter Office itself. But it's just not as tangential as a lot of stuff. Like, a lot of people like would never single out Lipstick Traces or Hullabaloo as their favourite Muse or Manic Street Preachers albums. But some people do go like, no, my favourite is Dead Letter Office. And I think some of that is that the band is having fun and they're kind of loose, and it offers an insight into how they work in the studio. Like, a lot of these are just live takes recorded to two tracks in one go. You've got the covers revealing the influence thing. It gives people... I used to love doing that, having a little map where you listen to your favourite artists talk about artists they like, and suddenly you've got little new avenues to go down. And then there's also another reason that it was popular, or maybe two reasons that it was popular. If you think about when it was released, and something that's really interesting, I think, is the form of the album. So think about when it was released. It's coming off the back of some mainstream success. So some people are just picking up the next REM album when they pick this, you know?
Yeah,
and in terms of form, when other people have maybe heard of REM, or maybe if they did like Life's Rich Pageant and they head down to the record store, they're presented with five REM records, the four albums and the B-sides compilation. And I saw quite a lot of people recounting this record buying experience in 1987. All five of the records are LPs, so they cost the same. Some are 10 tracks and some are 12, and this one was 15. So that is just, in theory, more music for your money. So they picked this up.
Better value.
Yeah.
And then they listened to it and went, oh, God, oops.
No, again, some for some of it, for some people, their favourite REM album.
Yes,
and then once the CD was out, it featured 20 tracks instead of 15, because they put Chronic Town as the last five tracks. It was the first time that the EP was available on CD, and the only time it was available on CD until like 2022, I think. It got reissued last year.
Right.
Year before last, if you're listening to this, when it actually comes out and you're not listening to it live as we're recording it. So there you go.
Can people do that? Can people listen to this live?
Yeah. No one's worked out how, but there is a way.
I mean, technically they can. They just have to like guess the Zoom link and join it. If they guess the meeting ID and guess the passcode to this particular Zoom meeting, if anyone ever susses it out, guesses it, you're welcome to watch the entire time.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
As long as you sit there silently, obviously.
I think the collection ends up being quite formative for a lot of people. Sometimes it's their first experience of REM, and for others, it's a look behind the curtain of REM. Mm. And so, yeah, it ends up being quite formative. It's some people's favourites. Tom York rates it very, very highly. Let's get going. We're not going to have loads to say about all the songs. So many of them are covers, you know. I think, you know, just under half of the album is covers.
News to me.
It was news to me. It was news to me upon doing my research. Like, I didn't recognise these as songs that I knew, because I don't know those bands.
Right, thank God he elaborated on that, because there was a little pause there and I thought he was saying, I didn't recognise these as songs that I knew.
There's at least one that I wouldn't recognise.
I recognise one of them as a song that I like knew and was aware of.
There's a handful of these that obviously we've heard before. On commentaries and stuff, we've watched them play some of these covers live. There's at least a few. Yeah,
and one of them we've heard on an album, sort of.
Let's get going. The sides are named. The first side is called Post Side, and the second side is called Script Side. Yeah,
it's good. P.S.
Post
letters.
Script. P.S.
Letters.
Yeah. And it's also the stuff that comes after the main text.
Yeah, that's
so it fits in nicely with it being a B-sides and rarities collection.
You know that you can follow up a PS with a PPS if you want to.
Yes. Post-script, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't the next one PPSS, which doesn't make sense?
No, it's PPPS.
Oh, it's just keep adding P's.
Just keep adding P's.
Keep peeing.
Absolutely. Here's the first track from Dead Letter Office. It's called Crazy. I've had this in my head the whole time we've been listening to the album. The chorus is so catchy.
Feet shaking in my arms and shaking in your face. Shaking in your toes and shaking
That's
on your
just,
bum.
It's going round and round and round my head. It's a cover. It's a cover by the band.
Is it?
The original band's called Pylon. Now, hang on. Wait. Obviously, we must play the B-side game. We've played this for all B-side episodes, and for new listeners, Steve and Lucas have to guess which album each B-side is related to. We introduced some new rules last time, but they were a bit confusing, so I've simplified them.
Okay.
Guesses just come at the end of the discussion, okay, before we move on to the next song, you'll get all of the clues and everything before you actually have to make a decision. And of course, some of these clues will come from Peter Buck himself in the liner notes for each song, which is cool. I think that opens up a new avenue in kind of like investigative work for you. But, so firstly, they're covering Athens contemporaries, Pylon. They were a huge part of the Athens music scene. They played with REM a lot in REM's early days. They were often shared a bill. Do you want to hear the original Crazy by Pylon?
Always.
Steve always wants to hear Crazy by Pylon.
Always.
Thank you. They actually kind of don't do the intro. They get straight into the more intelligible verse and the chorus, which I think is, that's R.E.M. Like, they're just like, let's get straight to the meat of the issue, you know?
I mean, it's kind of, though, it's kind of exactly the same, though, isn't it?
Well, that's what I think is quite cool. It reminds me of, like, in the 50s when you would just cover the single that's just come out and it would be exactly the same. It's almost like doing that, isn't it?
And was that a thing in the 50s?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What, like
the single would come out at the same time as someone's cover, basically come when the cover will come out like a week later or something.
That's just a very normal thing, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I like both versions of that. I think this is very cool. Yeah. It's quite dark, isn't it?
I think the verses are. And then the chorus is about dancing and stuff. I do think it sets the tone of the collection really nicely because it tells you that it's a cover. It's going to be some tangential stuff. It's not all lost classics or hidden gems. And it either reminds long-time listeners or shows new listeners that R.E.M. are at heart. It's kind of a fun party band, you know.
Yeah.
When you said it shows it's a cover, do you mean in the form of liner notes and stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. The band, of course, they formed to play at parties, and their sets were fast and had loads of covers, which remained true for about a decade, actually. And we said on the Life's Rich Pageant episodes that the party band, the guys having fun aspect of R.E.M., never truly leaves the band, you know, all the way. So in 1987, it's nice to be reminded of that early R.E.M. Energy. I nearly said R.E.M.-ergy, which...
I mean, I like it.
Why not?
Can we coin it?
Yeah, I think
R.E.M.-ergy. It's quite annoying to say. Kind of getting angry about it.
Are you saying R.E. and then emoji?
Yeah.
Yeah, an R.E. emoji.
Yeah, the religious education emoji.
It's that coexist symbol that has all of the religious symbols in it.
Yeah.
Okay, let's have a look at these liner notes from Peter Buck. Obviously, let's think about clues and stuff. We've got that they, you know, played with Parlin a lot in their early days. It's got the same energy as their early days when they were still a party band. Here's what Peter Buck has said about it. A song by Pylon. I remember hearing their version on the radio the day that Chronic Town came out and being suddenly depressed by how much better it was than our record. Outtake from Fables of the Reconstruction. Okay, so have a little... I'd wonder if there's anything in there that will maybe give you some clues about when sort of like this was a sort of B-side, when they recorded it, what album it's sort of related to.
Fables of the Reconstruction.
Steve's gone in real early. Lucas, what do you reckon?
I reckon it's Driver 8 and Wendell G from Fables of Reconstruction.
That's very specific.
Okay, yeah, cool. That's point each. Point each.
Nice.
Right. Do I only get one point?
Yeah, we stopped doing like points for singles and stuff, didn't we? Yeah, just one point.
That was a really good guess from me.
It was pretty good.
Well, I pieced together some information, I'm not going to lie.
It was there. It was like the snowman. He'd given you all the clues, Mr. Policeman.
What?
Have you not seen
that? Okay. Sorry, I was just going to go with it. What?
The next song is called There She Goes Again. Let's hear from Peter Buck first. Let's hear from his liner notes. One of several Velvet Underground songs that we've recorded. It was recorded live to 2-track with Mitch Easter playing acoustic guitar into the same mic as myself. I remember that I had to step forward to play the solo just like Bill Monroe. Outtake from Murmur. So there's maybe a couple of clues in there, guys, that you might be able to kind of I don't know, discern when this song was from. Don't tell me now. Don't tell me now.
I'll have a think. I'll have a think about that one.
But Lucas, you were saying during the thing of like the guy, Mike Mills doing the harmonies, maybe like stepping over to Stipe's mic to do the harmonies and stuff.
Yeah, into the same mic, yeah.
Maybe, because that's what they did with the acoustic guitars, and then he had to step forward to play the guitar solo. Like he says, like Bill Monroe, who was an American mandolinist, singer, and songwriter, and known as the father of bluegrass because he supposedly invented the genre. He invented bluegrass country music, apparently. Yeah. It's a sweet little ditty. It's a,
it's a little jaunty little 60s number.
I initially thought about how much it sounds like Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles. And then I thought, oh, that's quite cool because they're like evoking a 60s sound, which they've done often, and they're kind of drawing back from the past and things like that. And then, I sort of found out it's just the Velvet Underground cover, which makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, because they're from the 60s.
Yeah. They have sort of Beatles'd it up a bit, haven't they? Like early, it's a bit more sweet than the Velvet Underground version.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so.
Don't think I've ever heard the Velvet Underground version or even any Velvet Underground song in my life.
You have definitely heard Velvet Underground because we've played them to you on this podcast.
Okay.
In the last few weeks, in terms
apart
of release,
that.
Not recording. Okay, well, let's listen to a bit. But first, we should point out it is the first of three Velvet Underground covers that are on Dead Letter Office. And we've pointed them out as a huge influence on REM a number of times. Here is the original of There She Goes Again by the Velvet Underground and Nico.
I do think Steve is right. They have early Beatles'd it up a bit.
They've REM'd it. They've made it
a bit more like smooth. A little, playful, something you'd play on some TV show with a bunch of screaming girls.
And they're doing this.
It works well on an audio format.
And he's moving. He's Ringoing. He's basically Ringoing.
Wait, Ringo, I've got a guitar in my hand.
Yeah, but you're moving your head like Ringo.
I've got the guitar up really high.
Rocking side to side.
And I'm rocking from side to side going, there she goes.
And when you put your shoulders up like that, it does it like you're wearing a turtleneck and you've got a bit of a Beatles haircut going on. So it looks good.
My hair's nowhere near long enough to be Beatles-y.
It's not a mop top, but it's got a flop to it. It's a flop top. Why don't we go with a flop mop. Yeah, it's a flop mop. Yeah, why not? Yeah, no, you're right. Okay, it is. It's sweeter. It's a bit more Beatlesy. It's a bit more REM. They've smoothed out all of the edges that you get from. I mean, you just inherently get from having Lou Reed as a vocalist, I suppose.
That and the audio quality of recording in the 80s compared to the 60s.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Here's something interesting about Dead Letter Office. Okay.
Yeah, something.
In 1987, Velvet Underground albums were out of print. Because they weren't that popular when they were regularly making music. There's an often told hyperbolic story that the first Velvet Underground album sold 1,000 copies, and that was it. But everybody who owned one was influenced to form a much more successful band. And REM are a good example of that. But there's so many bands around the time of REM, or just before or just after, going like, Velvet Underground, one of my biggest influences, absolutely. But no, they weren't that popular. So Dead Letter Office became one of the few places that you could hear recordings of these songs. Isn't that interesting?
Okay. Yeah, that is insane.
You couldn't realistically, reliably go out and buy the Velvet Underground versions. You could buy the REM versions. And so this album turned a lot of people onto the Velvet Underground. So then there's like that thing we're talking about a roadmap and opening new avenues of music for you. This worked like a weird backwards influence where hearing the REM covers here encouraged people to seek out the originals, which then resulted in them kind of being rediscovered and then subsequently put back into print. Dead Letter Office is like a weird little part in the actual Velvet Underground story, which is quite fun.
Yeah. Yeah,
cool. Yeah, and that's the first of three. We're going to hear another two Velvet Underground covers before we're done here today. Opened with two covers. Notable, if not interesting, you know?
Why not?
Yeah. Now, did you or did you not remember Peter Buck saying that it was from Murmur? And would you like to have a guess?
I reckon it's the B-side of Radio Free Europe.
Now, that is from Murmur, as far
as I'm going so Murmur as well.
It's another point each. It's not nice. It's not bad. Not bad.
Two a piece.
Third track, Burning Down. Like that. I like when
Is it because it sounds like when he goes, a different artist goes, Raising in a Street. Oh.
No, I did not put
is
that
Is it because you love that indie song that goes, oh.
That's that? Also a cover, right? Isn't that?
Yeah,
isn't
that's Hounds of Love.
Future Head's cover of Hounds of Love by Kate Bush. Yeah. But that it is attached to a line that reminded me of a Mannix line.
Oh, yeah?
It sounds like licking my neck.
From the back of my neck.
Back of my neck. Oh.
There's a couple of weird lines in this one. There's a lot. They used the expression, got your goat, in a song, which is a bit of a funny thing to do.
We literally talked about that already on the season, I think, about completely tangentially, about what that means.
There's also a line that I don't quite understand, and I'd like Adam to explain, which is the line, strum your Jew's harp.
Your reeking gin.
A Jew's harp is an instrument. It's an actual instrument. It's a colloquial term for I'm not reading lyrics, so I don't know what the context of that is. But it's one of those things that you do you put it in your mouth? I think
why is it called a Jew's harp though? That's a
not really sure.
Weird, isn't it?
Yeah. Mouth harp, I think, is what people tend to go with now. But it was the 80s.
Or just a boy.
Yeah, pass me the boy.
Do you mean the
which blunt? Could also apply to a guitar? Because
I was just wondering what this kind of song is missing, and I wonder if you could maybe procure me one of the boy.
And then they immediately come back. They know exactly what you meant, and they get one. Yeah. And they're like, one of these.
We've got a few.
Yeah.
We've got the tenor boy. We've got the alto.
Alto boy. Something that I mean. Okay, this is classic REM, isn't it? REM. This is REM.
For the album that it exists on as well. Quite boppy.
Yeah.
Do you reckon?
I don't know what album it exists on until Adam gives me clues.
That might be something to do with when it was recorded rather than when it was released, because so Peter Buck says in his liner notes, this is another early song that we just got tired of. Recorded for Reckoning, remixed by Steve Felstad the next year. So it was recorded around Reckoning.
Which
maybe tells you it's a little bit more of a bop. But then it was remixed a year later, which will maybe tell you that it's for the next thing. But it's also one of their earliest songs. It was written in it's difficult.
The past.
It's difficult to say when it was written, but it has its basis is in a song from 1980. But something that did strike me is that this may well have been some people's first introduction to mumbly REM. Maybe they'd never heard mumbly REM. Maybe they'd gone straight from Life's Rich Pageant to Dead Letter Office, and they're like, what's this? Why do they sound so indie and twee when we're used to kind of the arena rock kind of thing, because it's jangly. It has that super melodic kind of bass line. You can only make out a handful of lyrics. You can like make out way less lyrics than you can on Life's Rich Pageant. But the ones that you can just about hear, they're kind of full of that interesting imagery. I think Running Water on a Sinking Boat.
Yeah, I like that one. That's cool.
Is one that I picked out. Outside of Dead Letter Office, they are now a rock band playing arenas. So people had no idea that they are typically... like how introspective their music is, or how insular the music is.
Yeah.
And so I was reading about this as well. To a lot of people, it was only at this point that Michael Stipe became representative of the shy artistic types who would rather read poetry and write in their journal than go to a nightclub. You know, you've seen them in classic 80s movies. They're always wearing denim jackets. They've got glasses on, and yeah, they've got big, long, curly hair like Michael Stipe did. And yeah, they're kind of nerds. And, you know, which is huge. It's another huge crossover point for REM, because can you dance to this song? Yes.
Yeah.
But is it also kind of moody and, oh, I'm mysterious and poetic? Yes. And that is ideal for a lot of people in the late 80s who are like...
And also Adam.
And also me. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I've not, will not be born for another 2 years. None of us will, which I think is also quite interesting. But the idea that it's got energy and introspection.
Yeah, it's
quite, are you saying I'm going to be born in 2 years' time?
Yeah, I'm talking about now.
Yeah.
Oh, mate, you don't know. A lot happens to you in the next 2 years. Let me
tell
you that.
We do like a bit of a...
Yeah.
There's some time travel.
There's some stuff going on.
And then I get brought back in time and raised from 1989 onwards, but actually I'm born in 2020.
We do a ceremony with pig's blood and we birth you out of an ostrich. It's weird. If we don't want to get into it now...
It's weird. It's weird.
Is that why me and ostriches have like a weird bond?
Yeah. Got like an affinity, haven't you?
Spoilers, I've noticed that.
Whenever we've driven past an ostrich farm, I see them all go like that, like just watching.
Yeah, they look at me.
Yeah.
And they look at me. And also, like, I've got a bit of a fetish for them as well.
Okay. Well, do you want to guess?
Lucas, it's the long, sexy legs, isn't it?
It's the long, sexy legs.
Long, sexy legs. Do you just see a pair of those?
And. Always naked. Always naked.
I'm not having it. I'm not having it. Guys, I mean, firstly, I love that. You guys know what that is. Do you have the capacity to access your memory and tell me what that is?
Seven Chinese Brothers.
Yes, it is the backing track of Seven Chinese Brothers.
It's the thing. It's when they were recording and Michael Stipe was being like too meek and quiet with his voice, and so he gave him some book of like, I don't really know what the book was. A gospel album, right?
It's not
right?
a book. It's a vinyl copy of a gospel album.
Yeah.
And then he came out and sung the liner notes.
He's just reading
to
the
music.
Get him out of his shell or something, right?
That and it kind of just, that's what this is.
Yeah, and it kind of like fucks, doesn't it?
To be honest, best thing on this collection, because it's just kind of interesting.
100%. I completely agree.
Just because it's interesting and weird. Like,
Lucas,
it's interesting hearing...
I prefer this to the original.
Yeah, I bet you do.
I'm close.
It's interesting It's interesting hearing him sing something that was never intended to be sung.
Yes. Absolutely.
Because like, obviously we've heard lyrics that are like baffling that they squoze those words into lyrics.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But this is like, well, it wasn't even intended to be lyrics. It's just putting a melody to... Even including like weird little like stage directions and stuff. It's weird. It's just, he's literally just reading it verbatim.
It's also the first time he's reading it, which is really impressive.
Oh, that's
right.
Weird.
He's doing it on site.
Yes.
So the album is The Joy of Knowing Jesus by The Revelers.
My favorite album.
Oh, absolutely. They're a gospel quartet.
I'm going to play another little bit of the song because there's a bit where it becomes more obvious that he's just reading liner notes.
Yes.
And also I love the bit where he just repeats the band name and then goes, "A must," which is at the end of, it's at the end of the liner notes. Yeah. And I think it's funny every time he does it. Here we go.
"Or to straighten out your life through the sincere testimony in the songs of the revelers. A must. J. Elmo Fagg, founder and leader of the Blue Ridge Quartet. For 23 years, from Temple Records, LST390. Planning to make a record, we are associated with the United Music World Recording Studios, Incorporated, West Columbia, South Carolina. The finest sound available anywhere. The joy of knowing Jesus, produced by Joel Gentry. Cover, backliner, design, resort. The Revelers. A must."
It's so good.
It cracks me up.
One of my favourite bits is, "As an artist, Rhonda Montgomery exemplifies piano artistry." That's Rhonda, an artist.
It's so silly. It's so fun. It fills me with joy. But it just, there's another thing where it just, it shows kind of how their songwriting is fantastic regardless of what the song is saying. Like, the chorus is still very, very soaring. The verse is still kind of fucking catchy. The instruments still play off each other, like, really, really well. And like I said, yeah, Stipe is sight reading the lyrics into the melody and making them kind of scan. And also having some fun with, like, knowing where to add spoken word bits and then just belting it out. His voice sounds, like, great on it.
Yeah.
Are we sure it's on First Sight? Because I thought I read that he, like, went away and had a bit of a read of it and then came back. And
the story, as Don Dixon and Michael Stipe tell it, is he's in the vocal booth. He literally chucks him the record over there and says, "Just use that," and then they go for it.
I assume they had Seven Chinese Brothers down at this point, and he already knew the melody. He wasn't making up the melody for
Seven Chinese Brothers there and then as well, because that'd be remarkable.
They've been playing it for live for ages. I mean, yeah, as Peter Buck says in the liner notes, he says, "This is the backing track to Seven Chinese Brothers with extemporaneous lyrics added by Michael in one take. A must." Outtake from Reckoning.
I mean, definitely the first few times I listened to this, I was like, "Wait, hang on. I know this song. Don't I know this song?"
Well, yeah, because it started and I had to check that, like, my playlist hadn't fucked up. I was like, why am I listening to Reckoning?
I just got confused. And I was like, or has this just become instantly familiar to me over, like, two listens or something?
That would be remarkable.
Which is the very opposite of me, so that would be surprising.
It also, technically, maybe, makes it the first REM song to have all of its lyrics printed. But it's just,
of course,
just on a different album. Which, the album, by the way, that album, The Joy of Knowing Jesus, now sells for between £700 and £1,000 because of this song.
Because of the liner notes.
And there's comments on the Discogs listings that are just like, "It's crazy that an offhand idea from Don Dixon in 1984 has led to an obscure record selling for $1,000 40 years later. Yeah. Somebody else posited that it's just an expensive lyric sheet, really. And I've never heard the album. It's not on stream or anything. It's just, it was a short press, kind of like bespoke, like, "Oh, we want to make a record. Let's get a few hundred pressed in the 80s. Or no, the 70s maybe. Can't find it. But yeah, definitely.
I've got,
like,
it.
Oh, well, yeah, but you know, you're such a music bod, you know, that you just try and collect all of these disparate sort of types of music, don't you? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. But definitely chalk me up as one of the, like, many people that prefer this to Seven Chinese Brothers. There's just
Which is interesting, isn't it?
It's got such a good vibe, and I think it's the spoken word. Him talking over the riff at one point is different as well, and I really like it. And it's almost got that kind of pastor sermon thing where he's just kind of talking at you.
And
it's cool.
And there's a really, like, delightful spontaneity. Like, you can hear him having fun. you know, and there's an infectious mood to it, and I think it's very joyful, and I think it's cool. The next song
isn't cool.
It's called Burning Hell. Burning Hell. Let's start with the liner notes on this one. Peter Buck has written, "Sometimes you write a song without even trying to. Sometimes those songs are the very best ones." That's not the case with this one, however.
I was really hoping he was about to say this is not one of those times or something.
Outtake
like that
from Fables of the Reconstruction. I love that liner note. Makes me laugh every time I read it. That he's that on his own
that's
album.
It.
He's just he's just going like, "This is a piece of shit."
Oh, it is though, isn't it?
He'd just bought an amp that had what Peter Buck calls a fuzzy button on it.
Right.
So he wrote a spoof of a heavy metal song so that he could use the fuzzy button in a recording and see what it did. And then everybody else leaned into the pastiche kind of spoof angle, like they're kind of almost making fun of heavy metal a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite a dark riff and it sounds kind of evil. It's maybe the most identifiably heavy thing that we've heard them do. For me, this might be just the disparate sort of ways that we describe heavy music now. And the idea of this being, you know, heavy metal is obviously laughable. But back in the 80s, you know, maybe. For me, it leans heavily into blues rock, and it has those kind of screeches, those vocal stuff that was things throughout, and Stipe's like putting on a voice. The lyrics are just so stupid. the opening is "Women got legs, men got pants, I've got the picnic, you've got the ants," which actually is pretty good.
Do you know what? Does context matter when listening to music, etc.? I hate this, and I hated this. Until you kind of said how they kind of presented it as, "Here's a load of shit, quite like this." This is quite funny.
It does change it. Because if this was something that the Manic Street Preachers like did, and they were like, listen to this, we're putting this next to some of our best B-sides or whatever. And you're just like, okay, it was a bit shit. But when the band go like, "Check out this fucking bollocks," you're like, "Yeah, okay, I will."
Yeah, all right, yeah, actually, yeah, I'm on board. Actually,
and it's got the big rock and roll ending as well, including you can hear one of them shouting "Thank you" in the background, which is also quite cool.
Yeah. I mean, we used to do that shit all the time in practice rooms, didn't we?
Yeah, of course, and that's what it is. It's like we're just kind of hanging out with REM. It's like a nice hangout record, you know?
I figured this one like had to be a cover just because it sounds so un-REM, and the fact that it's not is hilarious because it sounds like they're covering some metal band, but in fact it's just like stupid, dumb, fuck about. "Girls stop moving, boy behave, baby I'll put you in an early grave in hell."
it's cool
it's not cool, it's shit.
I know, but they know it's shit, so it's cool. That's the thing, all of the covers on this sound like REM, and a lot of the tangential stuff doesn't sound like REM, including kind of the next one, "White Tornado," not a cover. Doesn't hugely sound like REM, sounds more like REM than Burning Hell, but here's "White Tornado." Yeah. were having a little bop to that, weren't
we? Bop to that little ditty.
I just had a surf. Did anyone else have a quick surf?
Yeah, I did. I had a little, just a quick surf, just a quick one.
We're surfing now, mate. Aren't we? Are we surfing the web now? Because we're using the web to communicate.
I think so. How do you surf the web? Do you search for stuff?
Do you have to actively? Do you have to be actively going from thing to thing? Because like I've got a page open with my notes and I'm on a video call. Am I surfing the web?
No, I think you have to be browsing.
No, I think you're riding the waves of the net. Wait, what's the net?
So if I scroll down through my notes, am I browsing? And so I'm surfing the web.
I think you're surfing the web.
Maybe, man.
And
maybe.
The net. The web.
Would you stick this on to surf the web?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, why not? It's good, isn't it? Doesn't it fuck?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
It's just a little ditty, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's their version of Wipeout, isn't it? It's like their Wipeout.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's have a look at the liner notes.
What's Wipeout? It is that.
Yeah.
Liner notes. Peter Buck. We wrote this song the same afternoon we wrote Radio Free Europe, I think. This is an unreleased version recorded at Mitch Easter's drive-in studio at the same time as our first single on Hiptone. So there you go.
I heard that as drive-through studio, and I thought literally like driving a car.
That's why it's only under 2 minutes long.
You know where you do your order into the microphone? That's how you record into the microphone. You go around, they give you your record. Perfect. I'm on something there.
I feel like on Dead Letter Office, we've already had so many disparate influences and moods, but they've also kind of very much made them their own. We've had like contemporary indie rock band cover, 60s garage rock band cover interpreted through their own lens. We've had one of their very early jangly sort of sounds things. We've had the voice of Harold, which is its own thing altogether. Yep. We've had that dark, riffy little monster. We've had a surf instrumental, and they've made them all fit into their sound. I don't think there's anything on here where you're like, whoa, I can't believe that's REM. But there is lots of stuff on here where you go, it's interesting that that's REM, you know?
Yeah, you definitely say it's interesting that they're REM, definitely.
Yeah. And they do it on the next one, which is an Aerosmith cover, which again is like a...
Is it?
Yeah, Toys in the Attic.
Goodness sake.
Okay. Absolutely. And I think it's cool that they put out stuff like... This. Do you know who else has an under 2 minute surf rock instrumental song that we've covered?
Is it Aerosmith?
No, it's Radiohead. Do you remember they have that 2 meter, that 2 minute long surf thing that they were playing live? Do you know what they haven't done? They've never released it. Cowards. They are cowards.
Yeah.
And REM are just like, fuck it, put it out. Hello. I am interrupting this episode of our music podcast to talk to you about some more music. I'm here to talk to you about the album Squiggo 1 by Squiggo. That is spelled S-K-W-I-G-G-O. You can hear it playing underneath my sultry voice right now. And it's out now as well. It was released on the 16th of February, so by the time that this reaches your ears, you can go to all major streaming and distribution services, including Spotify, Bandcamp, and iTunes, and listen to it. You can probably tell from the sound of it that there's some inspirations here from PlayStation and PlayStation 2 soundtracks, if that's your kind of thing. We're thinking Silent Hill, Gran Turismo, Persona 3, Wipeout. A lot of the synths and sample sources that were used in the creation of this album were used on those old soundtracks. And Squiggo also... inspired by their recent trip to Japan, particularly the bustling nightlife in Osaka. But if you're not into old video games, you're going to find loads to love here because they've also taken influence from artists such as M83, Fortet, Aphex Twin, Burial. I can hear a lot of Burial in this, actually. Let's hear a little bit more. There you go, it's kind of electronic, but there's also a wider range of influences, such like, you know, there's stuff like ambient, the shoegaze, techno, it's got a kind of down-tempo mood, but on the album itself, there's a mixture of styles, you know, some songs are sad and nostalgic, those are for Steve, I guess, some are very, very chilled, that's for Lucas, and some might make you want to dance. Oh, apparently there's a scary one. I'm not even going to read that bit. I'm not even going to read it out. Anyway, it's out now, wherever you get your music. Squiggo 1 by Squiggo. Go and have a listen. Anyway, yes, the next one is an Aerosmith cover. The song is Toys in the Attic. We've seen them play that live before. In fact, it was, I think, Lucas, you were like, oh, I know this song, which is wild because I did not expect you to know loads of Aerosmith stuff.
No, neither do I, and I still don't know because I'd forgotten we'd seen this live, obviously.
Yeah.
And so I've got in my notes, same thing, like, I know this song. Why? Why do I know the first song off of Aerosmith's third album released in 1975? And apparently the song literally about toys in the attic.
Yeah, well,
about like toys that kids outgrow.
About leaving your childhood behind, you know?
Yeah, the end of Toy Story 3.
The end of Toy Story 3. Exactly.
I'm waving.
The waving.
He's waving. Yeah. I didn't know it was a cover, and I thought it was cool. They're kind of showing their punk side, though.
Aerosmith, very punk.
Well, this is showing their punk side, isn't it? This doesn't sound like arena glam rock or whatever Aerosmith are.
It definitely doesn't sound like that. Do you want to hear the original Toys in the Attic by Aerosmith? Because I think Aerosmith are more punk than you might be giving them credit for. Still a bit, it trends more towards cock rock than the REM one does.
See, what's weird is I don't feel like I recognise that. So is there a reason why I might recognise the REM one for some reason?
I don't think so.
Well, that would be weird.
The liner notes. Let's check in with Peter Buck. He wrote for this one, if you grew up in the 70s, you liked Aerosmith. This one is always fun to play live. Outtake from Life's Rich Pageant. I like that attitude. It has the air of, like, you can try and be as cool as you like and say that you don't like them now, but I know that you liked Aerosmith because everyone liked Aerosmith if you grew up in the 70s, you know? And it's like Coldplay. People can walk around being all Johnny Music and saying, I don't like Coldplay, but come on, there's a Coldplay song you like. Stop trying to be, you know? But I think that's an interesting thing about REM, and I think we've picked it out a couple of times, is that, okay, yeah, they're covering these, you know, Athens contemporaries in Pylon. Sure, they're covering the Velvet Underground, you know, this influential 60s band, you know. But they're also covering Aerosmith, one of the biggest sort of classic rock bands that there is, you know. And it makes sense that it comes from the Life's Rich Pageant era, I think. I think you can hear that.
Well, I just looked it up, and it was on the Fall On Me single, which is hilarious.
It's like, but then,
if you think about it, like, we have kind of been covering bands that will like almost curate the single, and it all, you know, like, was it the Empty Souls one from the Manix? Like, all sounds very similar.
Yeah.
I think the majority of B-sides, especially back in the day or wherever, it was just some any old shit that was just on the side that would just, it doesn't have to, well, yeah, that makes sense to go with this single because it sounds a bit like it, or it sounds a bit like the album. I mean, this is sort of probably quite normal, isn't it? You get Fall of Me because it's all introspective, quite nice, you know, slow kind of sound. And then Toys in the Attic, I thought, is on it. That's quite funny.
That's what Peter Buck was saying in the opening liner notes. He was like, you can do whatever the fuck you want on the B-side. Yeah. And that's what I like about them.
Yeah.
Although I will say, not a million miles away from something like Just a Touch, which is on Life's Rich Pageant. You know, that has that more sort of like punky sort of attitude to it.
True.
Fun, energetic way to close out the post side, I think. And the script side starts with something with energy as well. It's called Wind Out.
Oh, that's interesting. I've got a note that says it's aggressively acceptable.
Yeah, it's like a bit of a bop. It's not like, you know, it's not like, oh, what a fucking bop. It's just like a bit of a bop. Yeah.
What song, what is the context of the term black and yellow in some kind of song? Black and yellow, black and yellow, black
there
and yellow.
There was a song that went like black and yellow, black and yellow. That,
yeah, what's the song though? What is it?
I don't know, it came out in like 2008 and it was by a guy who was... who liked a specific football team and their colours were black and yellow. I don't know why I know this.
In this song, it's supposed to be black and yellow, black and yellow, black and yellow.
That is a pull. I haven't thought about that song for a while.
I don't even know what song I'm thinking about.
You're thinking about black and yellow.
Lucas, once again, playing into this weird type that I don't think he is, where he loves... mid-noughties indie music. like
it's not an indie song. It's a song by Wiz Khalifa.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
It's not an indie song.
Oh, I assumed it was indie. Fair enough.
And Steve, you're bang on, mate. It's all about like someone who's obsessed with the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Yeah.
Oh, lovely.
How do you know that?
I don't know. 2011, though. I was wrong.
The song was also featured in multiple trailers for the Lego Batman movie.
That makes sense.
That would be where you know it, surely.
Yeah. this song.
I know this song. I'm well into Wiz.
Wind Out is quite good.
It's fine.
It's rather good. It's very short, and this is on a soundtrack for something, right? Is it this one?
Yes, this is the only one that actually technically isn't a B-side. Let's see what Peter Buck said about it in the liner notes. He said, this is one of our earliest songs written in the summer of 1980. We recorded it for our second album. In retrospect, I think that it would have fit on Reckoning very well, but at the time we decided not to include it. It's from a soundtrack that shall remain nameless. So I don't think they want to talk about their association with the movie, but I'm going to blow up their spot. The film it was featured in was Bachelor Party, like a bit an 80s sex comedy, which is not really the REM vibe.
Really rude.
Yeah.
Does sex comedy still get made?
Yes. There was a really good one this year, and this year is 2023 for people listening.
Was it, was Bottoms a bit of a sex comedy as well?
That is supposed to be good. I haven't seen it. No Hard Feelings. No Hard Feelings is the one that I'm referring to. I really liked it because it was
sexy.
An original comedy aimed at adults. And I haven't seen one of those in fucking ages.
Yeah, it's a shame. Yeah. What happens to the comedy movie?
Yeah, I know, right? Well, it got Judd Apatow'd, didn't it?
But they don't happen anymore. At least those existed. Like,
well, do you still get the Adam McKay's? Do you still get the we'll show up with a bunch of comedians and cameras and see what happens?
Here's Will
those?
Ferrell again.
Yeah,
that kind of
do you
thing.
Get those?
Yeah.
Maybe we do. I don't know.
Where does it go? Because a lot of things that don't happen anymore is because they found another home, like TV or whatever. But where have the comedy movies gone?
I think that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is so all-encompassing that people just go like, well, they're funny. They're yeah. more or less comedies these days. Now we don't need to make any more comedies. Oh, is there an action movie out? Yeah, it's the Marvel.
Well, and also those people do get hired to make those films. Like they do
That's
get hired
true,
to
actually.
Go and do.
I was reading an article the other day where someone was saying that like the most quietly influential TV show for our current era is Community, because even though it wasn't that successful, everybody who worked on that show works for the MCU now. And they are writing those movies, and it's the same kind of humor, and you can see it like leaking through. Anyway, we got off on a movie tangent. I hate movies. This is a very
Listen to
early
Adam's movie podcast. What I am movie.
It's a very early song, but interesting because it marks the point at which Michael Stipe started writing in a more like that more oblique way that he would then become renowned for. Helped by his friend Jerry Ayers, who gets a co-writing credit on these lyrics. Before they wrote Wind Out, it was all his lyrics were about girls and politics, which is interesting because he comes back around to politics by the time we get to Life's Rich Pageant, as we've seen over the last few weeks. And there's those that middle period where he's like, I don't really want to, you know, I want to be more oblique. I want to be less seen. I think it's a confidence thing, actually. I think he doesn't like being visible, you know?
And then obviously their latest album was called Girls, 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 where he sings all about
yes,
girls.
Exactly. Well, that's when you joined the band, wasn't it? And you insisted on you insisted upon it.
No, when did I leave and join and leave the band again?
You joined in 1998, and I believe that you were with them up until the end. You'd have to tell us. You would have to tell us when we
yeah. We'd have to go back and remind me what I said I revealed it, because I don't remember.
Yeah. I'm with Lucas. Aggressively Acceptable, which is my version of a bit of a bop, and I think with the first track on side two, there's yet to be anything where I'm like, it's not even listenable. You know, everything's been fine so far, if not good.
I mean, Burning Hell was unlistenable.
Yeah, but it's Burning just, Hell has the thing yeah, that it's funny. A parody, so you're yeah. like, oh, it's funny.
Which
now.
Is good for the first 10 seconds. Yeah.
this next one is a bit more kind of like classic REM, right? This is
classic.
Ages of You. Classic. Now this is REM. Classic REM, in my opinion, or at least sort of classic of the stuff that we've covered so far.
The sound, yeah, it's definitely got that classic REM jangle sound. Lots of shalalalalas.
Lots of shalalalalas. There's a bit of context to it, which I will let Peter Buck tell us about. This is kind of a companion piece to Burning Down. When we got tired of that song, we kept the two pieces that we liked and rewrote the rest to come up with Ages of You.
Oh.
We got tired of that one also.
Okay, yeah.
recorded for Reckoning, also remixed by Steve, not you, Steve Fjellstad. This song came out of Burning Down, I think. And it also reminds me of Sitting Still from Murmur. And it was written around the same time.
It makes me kind of move around. Makes me kind of like bop around.
I think Sitting Still is much better, but I can see why this would have been a live favourite back in the day. But I can hear Sitting Still in it. The whole, like, this name we got, we all agreed. It's kind of like the same melody almost. Yeah. This version was recorded for Reckoning, as Peter Buck just told us. But there was a version recorded for Chronic Town. And this was the song that, if you remember, Mitch Easter said let down the rest of the track listing of the EP. And he got them to replace it with Wolves Lower, which is a good catch.
Yeah.
Because I don't think this is bad, but it's not Wolves Lower, in my opinion.
No.
And this one was released as a single from Dead Letter Office. It was one single from Dead Letter Office, which is interesting, isn't it? Because then it's not a B-side.
Yeah.
It's an A-side.
Adam, you must love this one, right?
Because it's about trains.
Because it's about trains. It's about trains.
What's that mean?
It's about trains. It's
not
about
trains. Is it?
Train pulls over hanging bridge. Conductor looks up. Thinks. There you go.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, yeah, fair enough. No, I do love trains in general.
Yeah, because, yeah.
But I think what Steve is referring to is very early on when I said one of my favourite REM songs is just about a train. And it is. It's Driver 8.
Yeah, Driver 8.
It's just about a train. It's just about a train. A nice train going through the nice countryside. It's a nice song for nice people. And that's why I like it, because I'm nice.
You sounded quite angry about that.
I'm nice.
Yeah, okay, sorry, yeah.
Don't look at me.
It's got kind of, it's very REM in the, I hate saying that, but it's got like farm imagery and like train passing through and seeing stuff. And it's got all of that. I like the line, the horses just don't gossip anymore. That's good.
That is good.
But yeah.
I didn't know about any of these lyrics. That is nice. The horses just don't gossip anymore. Yeah, that's kind of in keeping with like, yeah, the southern landscape and the time gone by and stuff. Like, that's very REM, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I meant by it. I hate going, well, that's REM. Because it is.
That sounds like REM. Because it's all REM, guys.
Wait, scroll
and
down.
Horses do fucking love a gossip, don't they?
They do.
They do. They're always nattering. Next one is it the last cover? No, it's not the last cover. No, not anywhere close to the last cover. But it is. It's the second Velvet Underground cover. This is Pale Blue Eyes.
Sometimes I feel so happy. Sometimes I feel so sad. Sometimes I feel just about everything. Lately I'm just feeling bad. Lately I'm just feeling bad. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Linger on.
Howdy, mister.
What an absolute just pure country song.
Yeah, I know.
Lucas, my first two words in my notes here are pure country.
Oh, lovely. You guys are syncing up.
Yeah.
Syncing up. Let's see what Peter Buck says about it. This is one of my favourite Lou Reed songs. Michael changed the lyrics considerably, and I added an exceedingly sloppy solo, recorded live to two-track, and is an outtake from Reckoning. Yeah, I think it's lovely, and it has that country lilt in its softness. The way the chorus lifts, the way the drums come in on the chorus is just absolutely excellent.
Yummy.
And we saw them play this. They opened with it on that televised show.
Yeah, that's mad.
We saw that was themed on folk rock. Yeah, one of their first big like televised concerts, and they opened with a country cover of a Velvet Underground song.
So mad.
Fair enough, REM.
Yeah.
They just don't care, do they?
They just don't care.
They're an interesting band. They managed to be punk whilst playing very slow country music. Do you want to hear the original?
Yeah.
Do you want to hear Pale Blue Eyes by the Velvet Underground?
Sometimes I feel so happy. Sometimes I feel so sad. Sometimes I feel so happy, but mostly you just make me mad. baby, you just make me mad. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Linger on your pale blue eyes.
How wonderful is that?
Lovely. It's not country though, so I don't like it.
No.
No, when it has not got anywhere near as much twang to it.
Because I only like country music now, guys, by the way. I'm really into country.
Cool. That's good for you. I like that for you, actually.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, it's good for me, actually, yeah.
I'm still waiting for my boots. They're being made. But we'll, yeah, oh, we should do like an unveiling sort of thing. Anyway, from one mood to another, I suppose.
Yeah.
This is Rotary 10 by R.E.M.
Maybe I hear the blues are calling. <down
like jazz?
Yeah, but like jazz and also surf rock.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I suppose so, but it's quite...
It's mainly diddly down down. But yeah, Lucas, did you enjoy Mills being all over your neck? I mean, the neck?
He was all over.
Is he over yours?
I mean,
sorry.
Off mic there, Steve did a little reference to the fact that it sounds like...
Maybe I hear the blues are calling.
Does salad and scrambled eggs.
Quite oh, stylish.
Mercy. Oh, we went with two different ones. That's lovely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That'd be fun, isn't it?
I know that you'll have it next to the thing, Lucas, but I'm genuinely interested. If you can narrow down a time period that this is from where you think they would have done this.
It could be anywhere. It could have been any...
I was not able to, but I it makes sense when you hear it for some reason. It makes like a weird kind of demented sense.
It sounds quite full, and I'm going to go Leicestershire Pageant.
Yes, it is. It is Leicestershire Pageant, which makes sense because I feel like it's in keeping with the band that did Underneath the Bunker and put Underneath the Bunker on the album, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I think they were recorded very close together. They're both attempts to make mood music, is what they described it as.
Mood sick.
Mood sick, indeed. Mm. The liner notes just say, a movie theme without a movie, outtake from Leicestershire Pageant.
Yeah, that works.
Which, makes sense. Makes sense. You know, I think maybe this is the one that is most where you would go like, is that R.E.M.? I can't believe that's R.E.M.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Is that actually a double bass? I think it is, right?
Might be, yeah. Now, to me, knowing the full gamut of their career, sounds like R.E.M.
Right, okay.
But at this point, it's weird that it sounds like R.E.M., I suppose. But I hear a lot of future projects in that sound. The next one, it's a bit more R.E.M.
Is it?
It's called
That's
Bandwagon.
What we do now, isn't it?
Come on aboard, I promise you, we won't hurt the horse. We'll treat him well, we'll feed him well. There's lots of room.
Okay, so liner notes. Let's go straight to Peter Buck for this one. This song was originally called The Fruity Song because of all the stupid chord changes. Still one of the funniest songs we've ever written, outtake from Fables of the Reconstruction. There's a fuller quote from Peter Buck, which is, "We purposely tried to put as many chord changes as we could into this song. We can't play it without laughing," which I think is quite funny. I think you have to, maybe you had to be there, because I don't think the humour of it necessarily translates.
Are you joking? It literally has the words "yes siree Barb" in it, and it's called Bandwagon.
Okay. No, it's not. It's called Bandwagon.
Okay. If you'd asked me 6 months ago if REM were this country, I'd have laughed at you. So maybe it is
really?
Funny.
Laughed and laughed.
I'd have laughed and laughed.
Oh, that's cool.
And laughed. Yeah.
I have heard some suggestions that it's about you two, not you and Lucas, not Stephen.
I don't
Lucas,
do that one anymore.
The band. I have heard that it is Stipe sarcastically welcoming people on board the REM bandwagon.
Okay.
As their sort of like stock rise a little bit. Either way, it seems to be about herd mentality or something like that. It's fun enough. It's sort of fine. It's a bit of a bop, Lucas. It's a bit of a bop.
I mean, the most noteworthy thing is the wagon, which is just textbook Stipe, isn't it?
Textbook Stipe. I love the bits that Steve was just putting to where it pauses and then goes back into. Yeah, that's always very, very satisfying. Okay, well, third and final Velvet Underground cover.
Right, okay.
This is Femme Fatale. I really like Michael Stipe's voice in general, but also on stuff like this where it's really raw and like, so the liner notes, the third of our Velvet Underground covers, recorded live to two track the same hour as Pale Blue Eyes, both outtakes from Reckoning. So they're just sat in the studio and they're just recording it live to tape, and this is what they sound like when they're playing. And I think his voice is like quite rough, but it's so like pretty and
it's fragile.
Yeah, there's a fragility in it, there's a vulnerability to it. And so then when he suddenly hits soaring notes, you're like, whoa, it kind of takes you back even more. I really like it. I think this is kind of like Pale Blue Eyes. It's quite compelling in its sweetness, I think.
Yeah, it's so sad.
Yeah,
sounding. But it's a song about a femme fatale, and the lyrics describe a femme fatale in the song Femme Fatale.
Oh, that's a good investigative work there, Steve. And people say you don't do your research.
Wow, I don't want to. I'm embarrassed now.
What specific femme fatale is it about, though?
Jessica Rabbit.
Yeah.
Is she the textbook? Is she like sort of the Rosetta Stone of femme fatales?
She's a parody. Of
she
them,
definitely
isn't she?
Didn't come first.
No, I reckon. I don't mean the first, but I mean, like, if you were to sort of kind of say, like, what's the definitive femme fatale in all of history, I think you probably would say Jessica Rabbit, wouldn't you? I reckon.
Probably not. I would probably pick. Who was it in The Maltese Falcon? Well, I'm asking you.
Jessica Rabbit.
Doesn't matter. We'll move on.
I think it's Jessica Rabbit, yeah.
That's right. I forgot they animated her into a bunch of old film noirs as well. That's right. I forgot about that. Lucas, I imagine this is pleasant for you to listen to, but unremarkable otherwise.
Well, it's back on. Pleasant to listen to. Utterly unremarkable. Glad it's a B-side collection, so I don't have to think too much about it.
Do you want to hear the original? There's a bit of a journey here, actually.
Cool. So what, this is Small Town Boy.
This is Femme Fatale by The Velvet Underground and Nico. Nico has a similar kind of vulnerability and fragility to her voice.
It's that, isn't it?
We've covered her on the
playlist. I was about to say, we've covered her recently, right? On the Ultimate Playlist.
Yeah, well, I put These Days in there.
That was it.
Songs about death, I think that's what it was. Yeah, or songs that remind you of death.
I seem to remember I liked it.
Yeah, it's lovely. But I have a feeling that they aren't necessarily covering the Velvet Underground and Nico version of Femme Fatale, because there's another band that we haven't really talked about that R.E.M. were heavily influenced by called Big Star, who also covered Femme Fatale by the Velvet Underground. Let's have a little listen to their version of it quickly. Heard Big Star before,
and not knowingly.
Can I play you a Christmas song?
I
don't know if it is actually a Christmas song, but it's definitely a song that gets played a lot at Christmas. I have a Christmas tree just behind me as well, because we're recording this in December, so it's topical. But I think this might be one of their more famous songs, and you might have heard it, but you will also maybe hear the REM in it.
Hear the REM.
Yeah, you can hear the REM even if you don't know the song specifically.
I've definitely never heard that at Christmas time. That's
interesting. I've played it to you on one of our Christmas episodes, I believe.
I've only ever heard it at Halloween.
I don't remember these things.
Fair enough.
When I say I've not heard something, what I mean is I haven't heard it the requisite 10 times for it to enter my brain.
Okay. But I played it 10 times in a row on the episode.
Yeah.
Don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, fine. Last couple of tracks sort of run together. The first one is called Walter's Theme. Walter's Theme. Someone, I don't mind which one of you, read me the lyrics if you can.
Go on, Steve.
Hey, this is David. I've got a hat the size of Oklahoma.
That's big.
Put on my boots and going down to Walter's. Get me some barbecue. Bring some home to the missus. He'll give you a bag to put it in. This is David signing off.
It's never written in the lyrics, but I'm pretty sure at the end he's going, bye. Bye.
Yeah. It's so nice.
Him saying, I've got a hat the size of Oklahoma, is a reference to the song Lonesome Cowboy Dave by Pearl Ubu. And it's just tape running in the studio as they fuck around. They are quite drunk, is what they are. And Buck does liner notes for both of the last tracks combined because they're one thing. You can hear them transition from one song to the other. They run into it. So let's have a listen to the next track, which is also the same bit of tape, and then we'll read the liner notes. So you can hear him trying to start the last song again.
Oh, he's saying the chorus.
Yeah.
I love the moment where you can hear that they're all kind of on board and realise that they're jamming that song and kind of all start getting on board with doing it. Because before that, it's all just kind of bits of stuff.
Because that's exactly what happened on stage when we saw him play it.
Yes, this is what they use to like vamp. We saw them play it in an impromptu fashion like this during the Fables commentary when Mike Mills' bass broke. And in this version, Michael Stipe does not know the lyrics. Peter Buck and Mike Mills are just trying to figure out how to get into the same key. You can hear them shouting the chords to each other to try to figure it all out. The liner notes in this one are for both of the previous, both of the last songs. And Peter Buck has this to say. I suppose that if we had any shame, we would have never allowed this little gem to see the light of day. This was recorded at the very end of a long, alcohol-soaked day, and I can barely remember cutting it. The first part was an attempt at writing a commercial for Walter's Barbecue. The second part is King of the Road, kind of. If there was any justice in the world, Roger Miller should be able to sue for what we did to this song. Which is, I love that the liner notes by the end just devolve into basically apologising and saying that the original writer should sue them, which is great. That's great. And again, that's, you know, he's talking about his own band.
I find the Walter's theme more funny though, that they just decided to start running a theme tune for a barbecue place.
They got drunk and went, what's the local barbecue place? Let's write a jingle for it. And I think that goes back to that that Mike Mills quote that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, which is like him saying, when we go into the recording studio, we're going in there to have fun. We're not necessarily looking to root out any home truths, which again is like half true. But there's definitely, there's definitely loads of stuff like this that they do in the studio. Buck has one last note to sum up the album. And he says, well, not a very uplifting way to end the album, but somehow appropriate. As Jefferson is wont to say, a little bit of aha and a whole lot of oh yeah. See you all later, Peter Buck.
Great.
So there you go. That's how you sum up Dead Letter Office by REM. What are your sort of general kind of thoughts on the whole thing?
I didn't know that REM could have a laugh.
Right, they're fun and they're loose.
So this is quite fun to listen to because it felt like that. Just like hearing that process of just them in the studio and just like you're listening in and stuff like that was quite cool. There's burning hells on here.
Yeah.
But that's fine, I guess. I mean, it's interesting it exists. But yeah, it's quite cool. It's quite fun to listen to you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think, Lucas?
Like, to even call it a B-sides collection is kind of not even really.
Well, they literally were B-sides.
Yeah.
I know, but like it more just feels like a little just kind of glimpse into them mucking about.
Feels like you're hanging out with them, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, like when you say like it's less, they take it less seriously than the Hullabaloo or the other one, the Mannix one.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously, because this like isn't like a real selection of like well curated, yeah. Well thought out B-sides. It's just a bunch of old bollocks that they've just gone like, yeah, you go on.
But I will say is this was all of their B-sides at this point.
That is mad, isn't it?
It's not like they've only selected the bollocks. They put out a bunch of bollocks as B-sides because they are,
yeah,
not a band that takes everything seriously. You know?
Well, see, it's their only B-sides. They're only unheard B's. No, because they're all heard on stuff.
They're all heard.
What? Yeah. This is all the B-sides they've had up until now?
I think so. They didn't release loads of singles. They released like two per album. We're only four albums in.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Fair enough.
So, yeah, but I mean, I can't think of another band we've covered that would release anything even close to this. I can't see Radiohead doing this.
No, they're way too precious. No. Way too
Mannix,
precious.
Muse, maybe, but I think even then they'd want to put like, no, these are our good B-sides.
No, they know? Wouldn't release it as a proper release. At the most, you'd get Muse releasing a little funny video,
yeah,
of them mucking about on Instagram Live.
Yeah. And
or
I
something.
I like that. I've for the whole series, I've been looking forward to talking about Dead Letter Office because it's very easy to get bogged down in such an influential band, such an important band, such a serious band that have a lot to say. They're going in the studio to make some fun records. And I think you sometimes get lost in how fun things like Reckoning and Life's Rich Pageant like really are. And I think this is way more on the fun side of the spectrum than even those albums. But it is a nice insight into what, you know, how they work, how they operate, the kind of band that they are. They're just going in there and they're all mates and they're having fun. And I like that. I think it's very endearing. And this time around, especially, it made me much more like, oh, they're my boys, you know? Like, I feel like I could relate to them like a little bit more now.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Do you guys
have related to them?
I'm related to them. Do you guys have any, like, just like a couple of maybe, I don't have to have thought about it, but a couple of songs that you go like, oh, those are worth listening to. For instance, mine are Voice of Harold and
yeah, same.
Pale Blue Eyes, I think is my other one.
Pale Blue Eyes, Bandwagon, Yeehaw.
Yeah, Yeehaw. Yeehaw.
That's all I like couple. Now, remember?
Yeah.
Mine would be, yeah, Voice of Harold and yeah. The really country one, but the first one,
Pale Blue Eyes.
Pale Blue Eyes, yeah,
lovely. So we've got the same highlights, Lucas. Don't think that's ever happened. Don't think it's ever happened.
It's happened every single episode we've ever done.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I forgot about every single episode we've ever done.
I wish I could.
When this was released, it was released to favourable reviews from most of the music press, and it sells like decently. It charted at number 52 in the album charts in the US and at number 60 in the UK. And then Ages of You reached number 39 on the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks. So Whoa. There you go. Yeah. A live album probably would have done better. They became a heavily bootlegged band in their early years. And that was like a combination of factors to that, right? It's like the energy of their performances. The fact that they changed their set list every night, or actually rather didn't really have set lists all the time. They just go on stage and figure out what they wanted to play. They did loads of covers, and every time they wrote a song, they'd immediately start playing it live. So they were like a live bootlegger's dream, because every time you recorded something, you'd get something new or something they hadn't done before. But REM found live albums to be a poor representation of the real thing, and said that bands only release live albums when they've run out of steam and they've run out of ideas. REM released their first live album in 2007, You just want to make a little note of that.
Okay, yeah.
That's when they've run out of steam and ideas, according to themselves.
Don't they stop in like 2008 or 9 or something?
11 is when they officially break up. Yes. But bootleggers also traded demo sessions and unreleased songs and in-studio cover recordings like the ones that we have here. And obviously, these were all B-sides, even if they were difficult to track down. They'd have been on a bootleg somewhere. It meant that there was not a single track on Dead Letter Office that hadn't already been available somewhere. So if you were heavily involved in that bootlegging scene, you had no real reason to buy Dead Letter Office. It's good for fans and people not into the bootlegs, though. And as I said, IRS are keen on making hay while the sun is shining. Is that the phrase? You make hay while the sun shines, is that right?
Make hay while the sun shines, yeah.
A Dead Letter Office is released just 4 months before their fifth studio album. And I believe you guys said you were expecting them to continue in their life's rich pageant kind of vein.
Yeah.
Is that still your prediction now?
Yeah, I think so.
Now that they've cleared some vaults and tidied up some stuff?
Yeah, this doesn't really affect any thoughts about anything.
Yeah,
it's just a load of old silly waffle, isn't it?
Load of old bloody B-sides, isn't it, guys?
Load of old bloody bollocks. Yeah.
Had to be said, I guess.
I mean, that's what the band called it.
That's true.
Weird that they used the word bloody when they're American. That's odd.
I know. Bloody B-sides.
That's so weird.
Let's talk about our listeners. Who are we going to dedicate this episode to? Who wants it? Brad Thorne.
Who wants it?
Lad,
Brad
Thorne,
do you want
absolute
it?
Absolute lad.
Do you want it, Brad Thorne? Come and get it. there you go. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. Our next episode is out next Monday, and we are going to check back in with some of those cheeky boys from Radiohead and give you a report on The Smile live in Brighton. So come and join us for that. But before you do, come and let us know what you think of Dead Letter Office. Is it your favourite REM album? Is it the first REM album you heard? Let's figure this out. I believe it's very popular. Are you Tom York? Tell us about your love of Dead Letter Office, please. This show always works best when it's in direct conversation with our listeners. So come and find us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at What Is Music Pod, TikTok at What Is Music. And if you want to send in something a little bit longer and we can read it out on the show, email us whatismusicpod@gmail.com. And if you liked what you heard here and thought I'd like to hear more of that, head over to our Patreon page. You're going to find all kinds of extra podcast shows. We're revisiting Manic Street Preachers. There's a show where we explore all kinds of different artists, genre, and eras to make themed playlists. There's bonus commentaries. There's music discussion episodes, ad-free episodes of this show, pretty amazing Discord community, and like a floating tyre, you know, like a tyre you get from a truck. That's sort of, but it's just sort of hanging there. It's quite abstract, really. You can head to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in the show notes for up to 2 podcast episodes every single week of your fucking life. There are also other ways that you can support us if you would like to. You could buy some of our merchandise over at whatismusicpod.redbubble.com. Or send us a little one-off donation over on ko-fi.com, which is ko-fi.com/whatismusic. Nearly got away from me. It nearly got away from me, Steve. I nearly went further with it.
Yeah.
The best way to support us, however, is to do what you are doing right now, which is listening to us. You can rate the show, subscribe to the show, share it with your friends, all of that stuff. That about does it. Thanks again for listening. We will see you next week. But for now, it's the end of the episode as we know it. And I feel like this episode was a must.
I feel country.
Okay.
You feel blue eyes.